and then the last time I spoke about taking refuge in the Dharma. And tonight it's going to be about taking refuge in the Sangha. On the surface, a lot of times, and again, I'm going to be sharing thoughts with you about this, these reflections, in the way that I have for the way I have spoken about taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma. And that's, there's almost like these different levels that we can take refuge at. And taking refuge in the Sangha, kind of on a surface level, a lot of times the way it has been spoken about in the tradition is it's taking refuge in the monastic community, in monastics, or taking refuge in people who have at least reached the first stage of awakening. But I think a way of getting an understanding of this for us here that you know really means something to us is seeing taking refuge more in terms of taking refuge in spiritual friendship. That's what I want to talk about tonight, is about taking refuge in Sangha as a way of seeing it as taking refuge in friendship, or taking refuge in a community of practitioners, just like this community here. So one day, Ananda was with the Buddha, and he says to the Buddha, Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, and he said to the Buddha, I think spiritual friendship is half the holy life. It's half the holy life. That's how much it is. And the Buddha said, don't say that, Ananda. That's not so. Spiritual friendship is the entire holy life. It's the entire holy life. I find it a really striking statement. You know, especially when you think about it, there's so much talk about, we talk so much about meditation. And there's so much silence and solitude, especially when we go on retreat. That's really what it's about, right? There's silence, there's solitude, and a lot of times a lot of meditation. And a lot of times, at least in this tradition here, is that is a lot of times the focal point, is this solitude and this meditation. Yet the Buddha's saying something really different here. And I think it's really important to think about, why did he say this? It's the holy life, spiritual friendship. And so I think it's no small matter what he's talking about. He's really obviously putting a great deal of emphasis on this. And you'll see that as I go on in my talk, you'll notice that the Buddha emphasizes this again and again, how important spiritual friendship is on this path. And I think it's especially important, this idea of spiritual friendship, in terms of a community of meditators. You know, what I've noticed, and it's, I was just speaking with somebody about this, is and I've noticed this, especially around meditators that have done a lot of very long meditation retreats and continue to do them, and I can say this because I've done a lot of that, is that there can be this this real skill and facility of going inside and being present with what's arising. Then when it comes to the interpersonal realm, there's something lacking sometimes. And I feel like it's very important to cultivate that aspect. You know, a lot of times the people that are interested in meditation, we're a little more introverted, right? It's not like you hear about these raging parties put on by Vipassana practitioners. This doesn't go together, right? So the flip side of that, though, is that there needs to be this fanning out of our practice into the interpersonal realm. I feel like it's very important. And I think that's what the Buddha's talking about, that this, too, is crucial for the spiritual life. And I know just a personal story, this is something that I've really had to make the intention for. You know, when I came out of the Zen monastery, I was good at sitting with whatever arose. I mean, I spent a lot of years sitting every day for long hours. So I could be in a relationship and really be with all the emotions that were coming up. But to communicate? I mean, that was really challenging. I mean, I really was this interpersonal dunce, you could say. And And it required me to make this intention to really make that my practice. And so it's become something that's very significant for me, for the practice. That the practice is not only what's happening on the cushion, it's also what's happening between us. You know, the way we're relating to each other. In a lot of ways, that's really what this practice is all about, is relationships. What kind of relationship do we have to our breath, or to a sound, or to an emotion? What kind of relationship do we have to the cashier at the grocery store? What kind of relationship do we have with our partner or with our friends? It's really about relationship. So yeah, I feel this is very important. And one other story, which I think will explain this and also lead us into some of the benefits of spiritual friendship, or why we want to take refuge in spiritual friendship. I remember very early on in my practice, I was in India and I was traveling around, and I was in Sarnath. Sarnath in India is the place where the Buddha gave his first discourse. And I was staying with this Tibetan fellow, and I would go over to this hotel to have breakfast. And I remember one morning coming across these English fellows who were on pilgrimage. I don't know, there's maybe five or six of them. And so each morning I would have breakfast with them. They were there for maybe a week or so. And what struck me so much about them was, one, their commitment to practice. They had this very deep commitment to this path and to this practice. But even more than that, and even more than their knowledge of Buddhism, it wasn't even that, it was their connection. I mean, there was this such a warm connection between all of them. And there was this lightheartedness and this support of one another's practice. It was just so wonderful to be around that kind of energy. And it was a different kind of friendship. And most importantly, what I got out of that was, it was really inspiring. And it was a different aspect of the practice that was inspiring. Not just the meditation, but the connection that was going on between them. And I think first and foremost, we take refuge in Sangha because it can be tremendously inspiring. And it's the living aspect of taking refuge, right? It's the lifeblood of these refuges. It's that which is alive, Sangha. So we go to refuge in Sangha, we go to refuge in spiritual friendship because it can inspire us. And you might want to take, you know, just a moment right now and just to reflect on, you know, there might have been people in your life or people that you know about that you find inspiring, that have inspired you for the spiritual life. Yeah. Can you think of those people? You know, it might be somebody that you've read about or someone that you're close to that you might have noticed, wow, there's been a change in their life. There might be able to be a change in my life. Or maybe it's a monastic or some other person, a teacher. And just when you reflect on that right now, you might notice what comes with that, what comes inside with that. Because I think what you might notice is there is this feeling of being inspired, being supported by that kind of relationship. So many stories I can't decide which ones to tell. There was, I guess I do want to tell this because it was quite significant. Again, it was something that happened when I was in India in the early times of my practices. I was on a train and I met this individual who had been ordained in the Western Buddhist Order, which is a Buddhist group mainly situated in England. And it's an interesting group because that's their main focus is spiritual friendship and Sangha. And that's kind of the hub of their practice, which I think is pretty neat. And so I got on the train, and it was like an 18-hour train across India. And I think, I don't know if either of us slept very much. And it was just this wonderful connection that I had with him, of him sharing with me his experiences in the Dharma. And also me beginning to witness his commitment to it. And again, it was incredibly inspiring. And not only inspiring, but it also became very supportive. It was, we had this very rich correspondence that went on for years. You know, he was in England and I was in the States, and we wrote back and forth, and it really helped support my practice in this very deep way. And again, that's the second aspect of spiritual friendship. It's not only inspiring, but it's supportive. And I want to say a few things just about friendship in general in terms of it being supportive. Again, I'm sure you can think of a time, you might want to, again, reflect right now of a time that was difficult for you. And can you think of a time where things were difficult and there was somebody there that you felt comfortable with, and just having their presence there helped you out? Have you ever noticed that? Just that just having someone there that's safe and supportive really helps with that difficult time. And they're not doing anything else other than simply being there. Has anyone ever experienced that? Yeah. Yeah. And you might have noticed also oppositely of giving that to someone, of the power of what it is just to be with somebody. Just that can be incredibly healing and incredibly supportive. We know this in our bones. Literally, we know it in our bones. And I want to share with you a poem about this. It's called Sweetness. It's by Stephen Dunn. And I think he's really speaking to this, to the power of friendship, to the power of connection. So he begins, he says, Just when it has seemed I couldn't bear one more friend waking with a tumor, one more maniac with a perfect reason, often a sweetness has come and changed nothing in the world, except the way I stumbled through it, for a while lost in the ignorance of loving someone or something. The world shrunk to mouth size, hand size, and never seeming small. I acknowledge there is no sweetness that doesn't leave a stain, no sweetness that's ever sufficiently sweet. Tonight, a friend called to say his lover was killed in a car he was driving. His voice was low and guttural. He repeated what he needed to repeat, and I repeated the one or two words we have for such grief, until we were speaking only in tones. Often a sweetness comes as if on loan, stays just long enough to make sense of what it means to be alive, then returns to its dark source. As for me, I don't care where it's been or what bitter road it's traveled to come so far, to taste so good. And that's kind of the magic, right, that happens when we're with somebody else, is that often this sweetness comes. Who knows where it comes from? As he says, almost as if it's on loan. But there it is, just by being with another person. So connection, spiritual friendship brings that sweetness, which again, we can take refuge in. It's taking refuge in that. And I want to point out that this connection is, I'm not speaking figuratively, it's literally healing. They did a study in Bosnia-Herzegovina. They were looking at, of course, there had been a tremendous amount of trauma that happened there. And they were studying the kind of intervention that was working most effectively for women who had symptoms of trauma. And so they were looking at CBT and these other interventions for trauma, and it was interesting what they found out was being the most effective. It was the women's knitting circle, right? That's what was really so powerfully healing, right? And it makes sense, right? These group of women getting together, getting together, connecting. Not only connecting, but knitting, right? Knitting their lives back together. Yeah. So we knit our lives back together when we're together with others. Daniel Goleman, if any of you have read that book, was it Social Intelligence? He has that wonderful phrase, we're wired to connect. We're literally made that way. So again, you know, literally healing comes when we're with another person. So even physiologically, like if you notice the way our nervous systems work, it's amazing. If you have somebody who's incredibly, you could say, activated, the best way to help their nervous system calm down is through social connection, safe social connection. Our systems are geared so that we have these receptors, you could say, in our brains and our bodies that are being aware of what's safe out there. And when it feels safe and there's a connection there, it helps really regulate us, right? And we know this also because of babies, right? That's what a mother's doing. A good mother, a good caregiver is helping that baby regulate. So we literally can help each other regulate these intense things in our lives. So again, literally connection, friendship is something that's healing. It's literally in our bones. It's in our physiology. I used to live in a community in London for a little while, and it was a community for the homeless of London, and it was the coolest community. I just have to say this. It was probably the most disorganized community I've ever been. But it had its purpose for being disorganized too. But the goal of the community was to... It had a different idea about what the needs of a person. And it said, you know, the organizations in London have it all wrong. And the way they have it wrong is all they provide for people is food and clothing and shelter. But they're missing probably the most essential need, and that was community. So it was just this incredible community where that was the intention, was to make community for those people living on the streets. And I thought that was really powerful to have that as an intention. And they really tried to target the people that were getting kicked out of the other homeless shelters too. So it was a crazy community, but it was a wonderful community. And I think there was something really powerful about that. And it was a different kind of community, too, in the sense of that's what its purpose was. You know, the other way it was different is that there wasn't any kind of rehabilitation to try to get people to get jobs or to get back out there in society again. Because there's a feeling, you know, was society providing the kind of community that people really need? So there were people in this community who had lived on the streets but then had decided to live in this community for the rest of their lives. And I thought that was also exciting. But it's not getting back there in society. It's about making community. That's what's important. But somehow we forget that. I think one more thing that's been really important for my practice in terms of this, in terms of taking refuge in spiritual friendship or taking refuge in Sangha, is that there was a point in my practice where I noticed that there were some things that I was not going to work through or become free of just through meditation. And that I really needed to have somebody else there, sometimes just meditating, but working with somebody else to actually become free of some things. And it was because the social connection allowed me to have almost a greater container. And I noticed this on retreats too, that sometimes, you know, I do this intervention somatic experiencing, which is a way of renegotiating trauma, that it can be amazing just to work with somebody for 20 minutes or a half an hour, and it can really help the practice continue to unfold. I think that's another place where spiritual friendship can be so supportive, is that this is not about me doing it on my own. That's actually not the path that the Buddha set up. He set up this entire community so that people could support one another towards liberation. And I think sometimes we can forget that in a society that's so individualistic. So again, spiritual friendship, it's supportive. It's supportive, you know, literally down to our bones. And it's not only supportive for the difficult stuff, but it's supportive for our practice, right? I'm sure a lot of you come here or come to a Sangha because you know how supportive it is to sit in a group. How supportive it is to be able to talk about the practice with somebody else, to share that commonality, right? I'm sure many of you know that. So it supports our practice. And not only that, when we come together in a group, not only does it support our practice, but just by sitting here and coming here, we're supporting each other. So I think that's really important. So it's about not only receiving spiritual friendship, it's a way of giving spiritual friendship. And the Buddha also points this out, actually in a number of places. There's a wonderful story about this young monk, Magiya. And he had gone out with the Buddha on alms round, and as the Buddha and Magiya were coming back from alms round, Magiya spotted this beautiful mango grove. I don't know if you've ever seen a mango tree, but they provide just some wonderful shade. You think about the heat of India, and here Magiya has this noble thought come up, right? He says to the Buddha, you know, Venerable Sir, I'd like to go and sit underneath the mango tree right now. Would that be all right if I go and do some meditation? I'm really feeling this inspiration to practice. Can I go alone and sit alone? And the Buddha says, you know what? This might not be the best time. Why don't you come back with me and wait? And Magiya, of course, being kind of excited, asked a second time. And then the Buddha said again, listen, this probably isn't the best time. And a third time, and everybody knows what happens on the third time. What's he going to do? So the Buddha says, all right, you know, do as you wish. So Magiya goes and sits underneath the mango tree, and lo and behold, after a little time, Magiya starts to be assailed by thoughts of ill will and sense desire, thoughts about doing harm. Really, he's getting overwhelmed in his meditation. Maybe you've experienced something like that at some point. You feel like you're being assailed by all these difficult thoughts and emotions. So that's what happened to Magiya. So he comes back to the Buddha and said, you won't believe what happened. I had a really rough time. And I'm sure the Buddha had one of those looks on his face. I told you so. And what the Buddha points out to him is he says, yeah, you need to have some foundation. And the first foundation that you need for this practice is spiritual friendship. That's what you really need, Magiya, spiritual friendship. And that's not what's in place yet. This is the first factor that's really needed on this path. Actually, in another place, the Buddha says to, he's talking to, you know, the monastics or to practitioners, and he says, if wanderers who are members of other sects should ask you, what friend are the prerequisites for the development of this path to awakening? You should answer, there is a case where a monk has admirable friends, admirable companions, and admirable comrades. This is the first prerequisite for the development of the path to awakening. Friends, that's the first thing that's needed. So it's especially important in the beginning of our meditation practice, on the beginning of this path. It's not only that, it's interesting when the Buddha is talking about something called the seven factors of enlightenment, which are these mental factors that are really so important for the mind to wake up, like equanimity and joy and tranquility. He says a good way to cultivate those things, if you want to cultivate equanimity, you hang out with friends that are equanimous. That's really what's going to help the mind have these wonderful mental factors. So again, it's spiritual friendship. It's not only meditation that develops this mind in a way that leads to awakening. It's community. It's people around us. It's really important. And I know how helpful that's been for me. I mean, I can really say that, you know, I couldn't have followed this path if I didn't have the support of friends and teachers. I think one of the most incredible things about studying with a Zen master that I studied with is that it was so inspiring to be around someone who he really believed this, and he took this as a fact that I could wake up. So there never was a doubt. When I came into his interview room, there was never a doubt that I could not wake up. And there was something incredible about being around that kind of confidence of, yeah, you can wake up and you just need to do this practice. There wasn't any doubt in his mind. And there was something incredibly inspiring about that. It really helped pick up and support my practice in a way that was needed. I think there's something else that we get when we take refuge in Sangha, that when we take refuge in spiritual friendship, is that spiritual friendship can really help with commitment. And this is so important on this path. You know, this path, in many ways, it really isn't a set of beliefs. It's more a way of life that's really based on and centered around some kind of commitment. And I think one of the most amazing things about being in a kind of a Zen monastic setting was just to have that support of community with that commitment. It was difficult to get up at 3:00 in the morning. I don't do it anymore. It's a lot easier when you have a group of people together doing that. It's really important. And not only is it important in terms of following a schedule or in terms of meditating, but also when you think about the spiritual path, you know, a lot of times the way the Buddha described the spiritual path is it's a path that's going against the stream. It's going against the stream of this society. You know, we're getting told all these different kinds of messages from the community around this. You'd be much happier if you were buying things. And so having a community that can help you go against the stream is incredibly important. Because this path is not going to be affirmed by this outer society a lot of times. So it's even more important to have this community in order to fulfill these commitments that you want to make. So how do we cultivate good friends? How do we cultivate being a spiritual friend, and how do we find spiritual friends? What are we looking for? So I'm going to start with this poem. I was going to read it later, but I think this embodies some of the feeling that comes from a true spiritual friendship. It's by Hafiz, the Sufi poet. I love this poem. The name of the poem is "The Sun Never Says." Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, "You owe me." Look what happens with a love like that. It lights the whole sky. So that's the quality of kindness that's in friendship, right? It's not this "you owe me" quality. And it has that boundlessness to it, that brilliance, just like the sun. So yeah, the Buddha gives some suggestions or things to look for in a friend. And I find this list really interesting, actually. So he says, practitioners, a friend endowed with 7 qualities is worth associating with. Which 7? A friend that gives what is hard to give. A friend that does what is hard to do. A friend that endures what is hard to endure. This is particularly interesting. A friend that reveals his or her secrets to you. And not only that, a friend that keeps your secrets. When misfortunes strike, this friend doesn't abandon you. When you're down and out, this friend doesn't look down on you. A friend endowed with these seven qualities is worth associating with. Great list, huh? It's interesting. Yeah. Sharing secrets, keeping secrets. Enduring what is hard to endure. And also, I think this is really important. When you're down and out, when things are going bad, this friend doesn't look down on you. They're right there with you. It's not judging you. Man, your practice must be bad. It's not that. It's just connecting. It's being with. It's really what friendship is about. So the seven qualities of a friend. And I think that's the other thing that's so important to remember about friendship is that, you know, these are the seven qualities that we want in friendship, that we want from a friend, that are so important in friendship. And I think we have to acknowledge and to allow people to be imperfect, to forgive and to notice that. We're all trying at this. We're all practicing at this. And we're going to have these moments of being imperfect. And I think it's important to allow for that in friendship. I think the other thing that the Buddha points out is that he really points out, I hope I can find this too, is that having friendship, he really points out our goal is not to be friends with everyone. He's really clear that it's cultivating friends that are going to support your practice. So there's a place to make boundaries, and there's a place to notice who are the people that you want really close to you and who are the people that you might be kind to but are not going to be close friends. This is important for the spiritual path. So it's not making friends out of everyone. As he says in the Dhammapada, do not look for bad company or live with people who do not care. Find friends who love the truth. Again, another wonderful quality to look for. It's really what's needed. I think it's a tricky balance. It's about having these clear boundaries in terms of knowing the friends that are really going to support us, seeing the relationships that are going to be oppressive, and finding the ones that are really going to allow us to grow, and cultivating those friendships that really allow us to grow, and actually taking refuge in those. And at the same time, I think we are called upon to somehow honor all beings and to venerate all beings. It's this tricky balance, and there is something to that. And I think in a weird way, that also, in a peculiar way, is a way of taking refuge in Sangha, or taking refuge in beings. You know, here it is. Shantideva actually speaks to this, and I find this really striking. And this is might sound like the opposite, but I think it's important to remember in terms of we want to be clear about who our friends are and who our friends are not, in a sense. And there's something about really having this attitude of venerating all beings at the same time. And Shantideva, who wrote this treatise, A Way to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, he speaks to this. He actually takes it to a little bit to an extreme, which I think can be very inspiring. So he's talking about difficult people in our lives. Right? So he says, because of those whose minds are full of anger, I engender patience in myself. They are thus the cause of patience, fit for veneration like the Dharma. So all those difficult people out there that we think are difficult, in a sense, we should be venerating them. Just the way we venerate the Dharma, we should be venerating those people because they're allowing us to cultivate patience. Wow. And here we are. We're always venerating the Dharma. That's crazy. That's what he's saying. That's crazy. He even goes further. He says, the state of Buddhahood depends on difficult beings and the Buddhas equally. By what tradition is it then that Buddhas, but not difficult beings, are revered? That's a crazy tradition. Their aims are not, of course, the same, but it is by their fruits that we should know them. And so we'd see the excellence of difficult beings. Difficult beings and the Buddhas are indeed the same. Yeah. And what's it like to cultivate that kind of attitude? When we find ourselves in some kind of situation there, it's almost like bowing down to that situation. It's that which is going to wake you up. That person, that situation is going to lead to liberation. And how often do we forget that? So it's this tricky balance. Yes, we want to have a community that's supporting us. We want friends that support us. And I think it's important to have this too. Yeah, this too can wake me up. This is the gateway. And then I think there's a deeper level to taking refuge in Sangha. And I spoke about this a little bit on the day retreat. And that's, Sangha literally means it's a group of parts harmoniously working together. So in a sense, it's taking refuge in the wholeness that we find within ourselves. And I find that this is incredibly important, especially in terms of meditation. Because you might notice a lot of times what happens in meditation is we're sitting here and then some experience arises that we want to exile. We don't want it to be part of the picture. Does anyone notice that? Yeah. And so a lot of this practice is instead taking refuge in this feeling that everything that's arising needs to be there. And what's it like to literally take refuge in that? And that can help us really start to cut down on this exiling process. So we're really resting in more of this wholeness. And what this comes down to is what I was speaking about earlier. It's really taking refuge in our relationship, the relationship that we have to things, and cultivating that. As I was saying, in many ways, that's what this practice is about. It's about relationship to my breath, to an emotion, to another person, to a situation. It's that relationship there. Sometimes I like to point out, and I find this is very important, you know, so many times there's this talk of I wake up, or you wake up, or they've woken up, or that person has woken up. And I think there's something off about that, that's incorrect about that way of speaking about waking up. I think it's more about a kind of relationship that wakes up. There's this wonderful book, and I love the title of it, and it's called Liberating Intimacy. But in a sense, we have this world that we live in that in a sense we're trying to become intimate with, and we have all these unskillful ways of being intimate with our experience. We're either pushing it away or grabbing onto it or checking out. Yet when we practice, we begin to liberate that intimacy. It becomes refined and real and authentic. So it really might not be a process of you waking up or me waking up, but it might be relationship or intimacy waking up through our practice. And that's why it's so important that we practice together, because then that can wake up. The Aboriginal activist Lilla Watson once said, and I think it's important to think about it in terms of her being an activist, also an Aboriginal activist, and to think about what the Aborigines have gone through in Australia. And she says, if you have come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you've come here because your liberation is tied with my liberation, then let's work together. I feel that really speaks to this practice. You know, my liberation is tied with your liberation. And your liberation is tied with mine. And for that reason, that's why taking refuge in Sangha is so important. Because it really embodies this quality of awakening. I know Thich Nhat Hanh once said that he felt that Maitreya Buddha, who's supposedly the Buddha to come, he feels will come as a community. I think there's something powerful about that idea. And it fits with Maitreya, right? Because that comes from metta, which is really friend. So it's this word that even has this connotation of friendship. And I think there's something true about that. And it speaks to the importance, once again, of taking refuge in Sangha, really seeking support from friendship or community. So may all of us, you know, find support and inspiration from our friends. Thank you. Are there any questions or comments or anything you'd like to share?
Sometimes you're in a group of people and there's one person who's maybe difficult, and you can say, okay, that's the gateway person or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point do you say, well, this person is disrupting what I'm working on and I need to move away from this person?
Yeah. Where is that point? Yeah.
Is there a point?
Yeah, and I think especially with something like that, that's what we need to sense inside and see what's next. What's needed for this? Because each situation is going to be different, each person's going to be different. But I think what's important is to begin to get a sense of that inside, of both of those things. One, of being able to be with that, and also being able to respond to that. Respond to that in the sense of really having these clear boundaries of what's needed there. You know, so many times we think of connection as being, you know, me being just like you or me being entwined with you. But connection happens when people are, in a sense, clearly boundaried. And then there can be a true connection that can happen. And that's only going to happen if you're really clear about what's needed there. And if you can't voice those, it's not only a disservice to yourself, but it's a disservice to that relationship in a sense too. So sometimes we think about it in terms of just me, but it's never just about me. It's about, again, I think that's why it's sometimes interesting to think about practice in terms of relationship. What does the relationship need? You know? It's shackled down. There's no taste of liberation here. What's needed? And that can also bring it out of this tendency of blaming too, if it's about the relationship. Is that? Hopefully, it probably won't give you much, which is even better, because it'd be horrible if I gave you an answer about that. I'm sorry, that's not very helpful. But I think you know what I mean and why I'm saying that. Yeah. But I think that's a really important question. That is really one of the key questions, isn't it, that we need to hold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sometimes you have someone in a group and the group is harmonious except for that one person. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to be distracting the group from the harmony. And the person who's being the distraction doesn't seem to be able to be brought into the harmony.
Yeah, and the first place to begin is to notice, oh, this is my experience of this group right now. Oh, wow, this is my experience of this group. I think that's really important. Oh, this is my experience of the group, rather than this is the way the group is right now. And this is the way this person is. I think that's where we need to begin. That's really important. Because that's really being clear about what I know. I know what my experience is, and I know how I'm being affected by this, and it's a great place to start. Wow, you know, I'm just getting this feeling. I'm really feeling, you know, closed down right now, and I wonder how it is for you, or, you know, and I just want to share that, you know. Could, you know, totally be me, and I just want to own that. Sometimes a place to begin. And sometimes it's not a place to begin in some situations.
Thank you. Actually, the difficult person that sitting in the group usually, I take acting class, and I try so hard to be so perfect, and I can't. I can't, but... they seem to accept me and love me the way it is. They've invited me and begged me to come back. So that's okay. I'm okay with it. But and when I showed up for an audition, they said, you don't need to audition. We've talked to your teacher. You got the part. I said, okay. Well, the difficult one. But what, I don't like to be different from all the others.
Yeah.
I want to be just like them.
Yeah.
So that I can sit in quietly and have a good time.
Yeah.
But it's not that way.
Yeah, and it might be, I mean, I'm just curious about this, and I'm wondering about this, is that sometimes I want to be just like everyone else, not because I really want to be like just everyone else, but what I really want is connection. And so I try to figure out all these different ways to connect, right? You know, sometimes I play the part that they give me. Sometimes maybe they give you the part of being the difficult one. So it's not really just about you, it's a dynamic. That's one thing. So sometimes maybe I play that or play another part. So I find myself maybe playing these roles in order to find connection. And I think part of the practice is to be more real or more authentic in the ways that we're trying to find connection. Yeah. So that's what I would be curious about. I'm just curious about that might be what's really wanting, what you're really wanting there is this connection rather than being the same. It's just that being the same is sometimes the avenue that we use. Feel safe to do that. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I went on a canoe trip with her. next to Eric, and they said, there's a problem here. I'm the only Spanish girl. And I remember him saying, I'm the only gay guy.
And so I think we have these desires sometimes to fit in. And there might be you just might want to be curious about there might be other ways to connect too.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just to be curious about that. And to honor that, I think there's something about, as I was saying, connecting is I think the Buddha was pointing out this too. This is a need. Just like food, clothing, shelter, this is a need. I think that's important to see. You know, we wouldn't ask somebody to go without food or without clothing or without shelter. And so it's really important to honor that need and to explore that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
First, I venerate you. And I've learned that has a double meaning. I was thinking of what recommendations you might give for what we look for in a teacher. It's something that's come up for our group from time to time because we have different people come in and out. And sometimes it almost feels like we need to do a long-distance learning course because we don't have, you know, regular people. But I wondered what you would suggest that you might have seen in other sanghas that would be useful to us as a group.
When I left Silver City, we actually had the same discussion because they were going to be needing to find another teacher because I was leaving. And this is my take, this is my feeling, is that to me, I feel an important thing that a teacher needs to meet kind of the sangha that's here now is a sensitivity to power and power dynamics. and is willing to talk about power. I think a lot of times what happens, what I've seen in sanghas a lot, especially as if there's a primary teacher, is that there can be an inability to talk about power and power dynamics. And power dynamics are always going on. And I think sometimes when one gets in a role of teaching, it's really easy to be blind about the kind of power one is wielding just because of the role that they're in. And I think there's something powerful about having a teacher that is aware of that and is willing to discuss it and be open with it. So that would be, that might not apply to the situations that you have teachers come and go. But to me, I feel that that's a very important aspect of the practice and an important aspect of teaching and being a teacher, is to be aware of that. And it's not something that's always talked about. It hasn't been a need to talk about it because this is coming from a different culture where there was a very clear power structure. You know, in Asia, there's a very clear power structure. But power is different here. And I think, and in some ways, it's great how it's different. Because the way that we've questioned power and dynamics between people has started to, I think we've been able to address kinds of oppression that haven't been addressed previously, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now the role of women in the community is really changing. And that's because we're talking about power, we're talking about oppression. So what a wonderful thing that the West is starting to bring to this practice. So I think that would just be one thing to look for in terms of that. I mean, there might be, I know there's probably lists of qualities you're supposed to have in a teacher, but that's the one I emphasize because it's not talked about and it's not emphasized sometimes.
Because as you were speaking, I thought that I looked for the same kind of things you were describing as looking for a spiritual friend. And I often like to very much admire the person, you know, and you can feel the practice and the presence in mm-hmm. the teacher that you do. But people have different things they're looking for in teachers as well.
I guess I'm not talking personally, but I'm talking more as a community. I'm sorry. I think personally looking for a teacher might be different, but a community looking for a teacher, I think it's, I just think it's important. Personally, I think it's that connection, if you're inspired or not. It's the heart connection for me a lot of times. Yeah. But it's a good question. I think there's all kinds of lists the Buddha gives about that. And they're walking the walk, not just talking the talk.
Brian, is a wonderful story that I can't remember all the points of, but it was about a teacher that had this retreat, and there was this one person that was just getting everybody really upset. And they came to the teacher and said, "Look, why don't you give him his money back and get him to leave?" And the teacher said, "Give him his money back. I pay him to come." He's the yeast. He's the yeast that works on their practice. I wish I could remember.
Didn't Gurdjieff do that?
Gurdjieff.
In his community, they had a community. Was it in Paris or something?
Yes,
or
that's it.
France, yeah. In France, yeah. Paid him to be in the community. Everybody else had to pay. And
So that's another way to look at difficult people.
Venerate, Good. Thank you.